If you've been following anything about the war in Iraq, you may have heard the name Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He was the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And our next guest helped catch him. His name is Matthew Alexander. He served 14 years in the United States Air Force and was one of our lead interrogators in Iraq, and has written about that experience in a new book called How to Break a Terrorist, The U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. Matthew, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
Thank you for having me.
Your book is dedicated to the soldiers who have died in this war. Now more than 4,000 American lives have been lost. Did what you and your colleagues did save lives?
Certainly it did save thousands of lives. I say that the real heroes are the men and women that didn't come back. And we lost several soldiers just while I was in Iraq trying to chase and catch Zarqawi. And those are the people that I dedicated the book to.
In the title of the book, the subtitle talks about using brains, not brutality. Was that a change of mindset when you went over there?
It was a change for this war, I think. Back as far as World War II, we were using approaches that were to interrogate based on relationship building. And there's plenty of stories from World War II of the successes they achieved by using those approaches and not resorting to brutality. And but that changed after 9/11. And a lot of interrogators who had operated at the beginning of the war in at Guantanamo Bay or early Afghanistan or Iraq had been operating under other rules which allowed certain things which I consider to be torture. And so when I got to Iraq, there was a need for change. And some interrogators who were there before me had started it. Had said they weren't going to use those techniques, and I just my group came in and continued that and said we're not going to use these either, and we're also going to add in all of our experience from criminal investigations to make this better.
Who officially changed the policy so that torture was used, and then who changed it back so that it wasn't used, or was that your decision?
Well, I have to point officially to the policy. I have to point to the results of the recent bipartisan Senate report, which did an investigation on that. And, they outlined very clearly in that report, which you can look at online, where they think the policy started and how it started. I know that for my group, I just made it clear to my group, my team of interrogators, we're not going to resort to torture. And even furthermore, we're not even going to resort to harsh methods that are counterproductive to what we're trying to accomplish. Because there's certainly many ways to be harsh in an interrogation or to use fear and control, which are legal, but are counterproductive to getting somebody to cooperate.
How are they counterproductive?
Because, first of all, when you go into an interrogation booth and you sit down with these hardened members of al-Qaeda, many of them, when they walk into that booth, they have a lot of hate for us. And you walk in and use harsh methods or try to use fear or control over them, it just hardens their resolve. They expect it, for one thing. I mean, many of them, most of them, almost all of them, have seen the pictures of Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay, and so they expect that that's what we're going to do, so they're prepared for it as well. What they're not prepared for is to sit down with somebody who treats them with respect, who shows them that they understand their religion and respect their beliefs, and who reaches out to them in a spirit of cooperation.
But beyond that respect, you used the phrase relationship building earlier.
That's correct.
Did you get to be friends with these people?
I think that's semantics. Whether or not I became friends with them necessarily within my role as an interrogator as a person, no. We might develop that friendship in the interrogation booth, but as an interrogator, I always know that at the end of the day, my job is to get intelligence information. But let me say this. I talk a lot in the book about the fact that my team of interrogators, what we discovered is that these were men that we interrogated. They were human beings. They had reasons for joining al-Qaeda, but they didn't all hate us. They didn't all hate Americans. They didn't want to come over here and attack us. A large majority of Sunni Iraqis who joined al-Qaeda were regular people, and they had joined for a variety of reasons, whether it be economic or tribal affiliations. And in a lot of cases for protection from Shia militias, but that they weren't al-Qaeda extremists.
They weren't extremists?
No.
But they had signed on for the cause?
Yeah, it was almost a, it was a relationship of convenience. The members of the Sunni tribes who had joined al-Qaeda had done it out of need. As one guy put it to me, You know, we didn't like Al-Qaeda. We didn't like the fact that they were killing other Muslims. But where else were we going to get money and arms to defend ourselves from the Shia militias that you Americans allowed to run loose?
Mm.
And that was a fair criticism. At the beginning of the war, we had obviously mismanaged post-Saddam Iraq and allowed the Shia militias to flourish and carry out reprisal killings. And the Sunnis had turned the only place that they could for protection.
Talking with Matthew Alexander, 14 years in the United States Air Force, one of our lead interrogators in Iraq, and author of a new book called How to Break a Terrorist here on the Big 550 KTRS. I'm fascinated by process, Matthew. Can you tell me a little bit about, you have somebody who has been picked up by special forces or regular forces, and they've been brought to you for interrogation, and you're going to take them into that room. How much do you know about them before you even start talking to them?
In some cases, you know nothing. In some cases, all we knew was he was captured in a house and there were suicide bombers in the house. And in some cases, we knew, okay, we caught this guy who we've been looking for, and other detainees have told us a lot about them. We know everything about them. So it depends on the detainee. As an interrogator, it's incumbent upon us to walk in there with an open mind, though, and to be able to treat each person as an individual who has unique motivations and to be able to analyze those.
And then do you have a goal from the very first moment you start talking to them that you are going to find out X, Y, and Z?
You have a list of questions that analysts give you, and I always try to paint this as a bigger picture. You know, it's not just interrogators. There's a whole team involved in this process. And then the analysts are vital to being able to put the piece of the puzzle together. So they kind of tell you what information they want you to get. And so you go in there with an idea of what you want, but then again, you'll take anything you can get because there might be some questions that you don't have that the detainee knows and can provide information about.
Were there times when you were interrogating somebody where they would tell you something and you were shocked that, A, they had that information, or, B, they were telling you something that you and the analyst didn't even know?
Yeah, let me take you into a story in the book about the man who eventually gave us Zarqawi. Here's a man who had been interrogated using old methods based on fear and control for 20 days, and he refused to give anything. And I sat down with him for about 6 hours, right before he was supposed to get on a helicopter and leave and be gone. And it wasn't until the last few minutes that I was able to convince him to cooperate. But at the time, I posed this question to him. I said, you know, I know somebody that you know in Al-Qaeda who's very high up. And you know who I'm talking about. And if you tell me the name, then we can work together and I can trust you. And I had absolutely nobody in mind. I'd completely made it up. And he said he thought about it for quite a while, maybe 30 seconds or a minute went by, and finally he said, Abu Ayyub al-Masri, who happens to be now the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq and at the time was the number two guy. And I was shocked inside because that I didn't have anybody in mind, but also because he just admitted that he was in the inner circle of Zarqawi.
Wow.
I knew that if he... You know, detainees tell you at most half-truths when they first decide to cooperate or break, as we use in interrogator lingo. I knew that if he said he knew al-Masri, they certainly knew al-Zarqawi.
And at that point, do you have to have a poker face and act like, yeah, well, that's exactly the name I was looking for. Good one.
You have to have a perfect poker face. And in the case of this guy, I describe him in the book, he's like Hannibal Lecter, literally. He's very similar in mannerisms and speech. And he was very articulate, he was very manipulative, extremely intelligent, and so I had to have a perfect poker face at that point.
And at that point, you know you've got him, and you're going to be able to use him as a pipeline for information, right?
Yeah, it took a little bit more, you know, I'll leave that to the book, but it took a lot more from that point to get him to give us Zarqawi. It took some more trickery and some more good old American ingenuity. But eventually, yeah, he was the one who told us how to get to Zarqawi.
And I know, Matthew, there will be people who are listening to us today and who might hear about your book who think that you are giving away secrets and helping the enemy by telling them how we do our interrogations and giving away those techniques. What do you say to those critics?
Well, first thing I'll say is they're unclassified. You know, Department of Defense actually made that decision, not me. So the Army Field Manual on Interrogation Techniques is unclassified. The other thing I would say is, you know, I equate it to a football game. Both sides know the rules, and they both know the types of plays that can be called. But it's still up to somebody to win through being smarter. And so I also say, you know, Al-Qaeda knows how M16s work, and they know that you point the skinny end at things, but they can't stop bullets. And the same way with interrogation techniques. They can know what the techniques are, but it doesn't mean they can resist them.
That's a very good line. I like that a lot. Did you find resistance from some of our own intelligence personnel to your methods?
Definitely. There were some people who never bought into the fact that relationship building works and that it works faster than brutality methods or methods based on fear and control. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I think part of it has to do with ignorance. I think part of it has to do with the fact that they're just looking at interrogations in an entirely wrong manner. You know, interrogations is not about retribution, and it's not about domination. Interrogations is about cooperation and negotiation. And I know that from my background as a criminal investigator, and that's the way we're taught to conduct criminal investigations because it's what works.
How much of a barrier was language in your interrogations?
I would say almost zero. And the reason why, I don't speak Arabic. I always used an interpreter, except in several cases where, actually, amazingly, a lot of Iraqis speak English. And so I found that when I had an interpreter in the booth with me, it was an advantage because most of our interpreters are extremely smart. These people, a lot of them had doctorate degrees or master's or had been well-educated, and they're a cultural encyclopedia sitting next to you. So often a detainee would say something and reply to me, and my interpreter would stop and tell me, hey, this is what they said, but here's what they meant.
Hmm.
Here's how it's culturally significant. And I tell a story in the book of how this saved me, really, one time with a guy who had married a second wife. And I didn't really catch the entire significance of why he had taken on a second wife until my interpreter explained it to me. And that's what allowed me to address what motivated him to join Al-Qaeda.
So you had to trust your interrogators to be almost your, not just verbal lifeline to these people, but your cultural lifeline. Does that mean that you were hiring Iraqis to do that job?
These are Americans that are doing these jobs. Some of them are from Iraq. Some of them have been in the States for 10, 20, 30 years. Some of them, I had people from all over. I had, they're all Americans, but some of them had come from, had one guy from Jordan. I had some guy from Egypt, had a female from southern Iraq, and they were all excellent. What they did.
You talked about not having to use fear as a motivator to get information here. Were there times where you were in there with some of these monsters where you were afraid at all?
No. In fact, there was one moment I talk about in the book where I'm interrogating this guy who's like Hannibal Lecter and trying to convince him to cooperate. And we have this 5.5-hour conversation where we never discuss anything that has to do with the insurgency or with Al-Qaeda, where we're just having general conversations so I can build a relationship with him. And at one point, we talk about martial arts, and he happens to be a big fan of the Ultimate Fighting Championships, and he happens to mention to me that he studied martial arts for 14 years, and he has a black belt. And at that one second, it occurred to me that I was sitting a foot across from him, and he was much larger than I was, but I never felt any type of fear security-wise, and I'd never actually even heard of a detainee ever attacking an interrogator.
Are they restrained during interrogation?
No, they are not restrained.
Do they get up and walk around? I mean,
No, they could if they wanted to, but as an interrogator, you probably would be uncomfortable with them up and walking around. But sometimes I actually did encourage them to do that because it puts them at ease. And the more you can put them at ease, the better it is towards getting them to cooperate.
5.5 hours. Was that the only time you talked to this guy, or do you go back to them repeatedly and say, okay, last time we talked about this, and now we're going to have to go back to that because I need more information about this or that or the other thing?
Yeah, some people who read my book, they say, this is so intense, and all you did was eat, sleep, drink interrogations every day. And I explained to them, yeah, and you're only reading about one or two interrogations per day. We were doing each interrogator was doing 3, sometimes 4, and I was supervising over 30 per day.
Mm.
So you interrogate, it depends on the detainee, how much time you have, because we're so interrogators work so hard and they only have so much time. And so normally maybe 3 hours could be as long as 8 hours sometimes in a day.
Sounds mentally exhausting.
It is. And that's why the interrogators that we recruit and that are doing the job are so well. Well, they're top quality.
What is the status of al-Qaeda these days, Matthew?
Well, I think al-Qaeda in Iraq has definitely on the run or been diminished significantly because of our policy of reaching out to Sunni Iraqis and pulling them back away from al-Qaeda. General Petraeus, when he got there the year after I left, he enacted a policy that some Marines and Army soldiers had started out in Anbar province of reaching out to the Sunnis. And so al-Qaeda, you know, the Sunni Iraqis ultimately rejected Zarqawi's idea, his message of hate and intolerance, and that significantly improved the security situation. I think in Afghanistan, you know, there's plenty of reports about the resurgence of the Taliban. But what I say is that, you know, interrogations is kind of a metaphor for how we fight this entire war, and that is we have to approach it in a spirit of negotiation, cooperation. Occasionally we're going to have to use the military to eliminate extremist elements, but it can't be about domination. That's not going to work in the long run.
When you would deal with some of these al-Qaeda members, either as prisoners who you were interrogating or in people you were trying to get, you mentioned before that in some cases these were just Sunnis who needed money or needed help, so they weren't all fanatics. But you must have run into some who were true al-Qaeda believers who had come to Iraq for a reason. What was the reason that they were there?
Well, the number one reason that we heard day in and day out that foreign fighters gave for coming to Iraq to fight was because of Abu Ghraib and because of Guantanamo Bay, because of the torture and because of the abuse. And you have to put this within a cultural context, too, for Muslims to see those pictures and to hear the stories of Abu Ghraib and to understand that Muslims were being tortured. It's a shared shame within the culture. And it's not unlike the way that Americans felt when they found out that our POWs were being tortured in Vietnam. So it was a huge motivator, and it was a very effective recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. Imams all across the Middle East were using that to recruit fighters. And so this hurt us in the long run, and it was counterproductive to what we were trying to accomplish in Iraq.
So when Vice President Dick Cheney says that using torture saved American lives, you're saying that it may have cost lives?
I'm not saying may. I'm saying it did. We have literally lost hundreds, if not thousands, of American lives because of our torture policy. The number of lives that it saved in the short term has been far outweighed by the number of lives we've lost in the long term. And we owe it to our troops to do better than that. And that's just pragmatically. That's just the pragmatic argument. The damage or the loss in terms of our national image, in terms of the erosion of our American principles, I think is even a more important question. George Washington forbid his troops from torturing prisoners of war. Abraham Lincoln forbid the troops from torturing prisoners of war. In World War II, we didn't use torture. We maintained American integrity while effectively interrogating prisoners of war. And so we owe it to the founders of this country to uphold those traditions.
Are we still torturing?
I believe as long as we're waterboarding, we're torturing. And until we outlaw waterboarding and any other form of torture across the entire U.S. government, it doesn't matter what agency you're in, then I think, yes, we're still torturing.
But be honest with me about this, Matthew. Even if Obama gets in there on January 20th and the first thing he did was sign a piece of paper banning anyone, any American, from torturing anyone in an interrogation for any reason, it would still go on, wouldn't it?
I don't think so. And I'll say this. I never believe that something becomes justified because it's classified. We're Americans, and it doesn't matter the status of who we're fighting, where they are, what they've done to us. We should always uphold American principles.
Talking with Matthew Alexander about his book, How to Break a Terrorist, here on the Big 550 KTRS. You talked about things being classified. You actually had to sue the Department of Defense over some of the material in your book, didn't you?
I did. I submitted my book for review, and at first the Department of Defense refused to do the review. A couple deadlines passed, and so I sued them to force them to do the review, and then they extracted a large amount of unclassified material. There's 93 redactions, which was a significant part of the book.
It's very weird reading a book and coming to a block of black ink.
Yeah, now there's only 13 redactions left in, and I'm still arguing those, but, you know, I sued them, and I used an appeal, and eventually they relented on 80 of them, admitting that they were unclassified or they were just my opinions, which I'm allowed to express.
Right.
And so, you know, I can't say that this was incompetence. To me, it pointed towards either retribution or an attempt at censorship. And the American people have a right to know what works in the interrogation booth and to hear the fact that we caught the most wanted terrorist in the world using non-coercive techniques that had nothing to do with torture.
Were there some detainees who you couldn't break?
Of course. In fact, I was talking to Colonel Steve Kleinman, who's another very experienced interrogator who's done hundreds of interrogations last night. And we were discussing the fact, you know, you can't, if you expect interrogation to get every single person to talk, that's like expecting a doctor to cure every patient. It's not going to happen. Some people will never talk. The goal of interrogation is to get the largest number of people who potentially could talk to talk. And that's what these techniques do of relationship building.
Did you ever go back to one of these guys who you couldn't break and say, look, we know you're not going to give us the information, but guess what? Next door, one of my buddies was talking to one of your buddies.
We use that all the time. That was a prisoner's dilemma. In fact, I have this story that's not in the book, but I plan to publish in another form here shortly, of a guy who was caught with three buddies. And eventually I told him, hey, you're going to get released tomorrow, but I just want you to know your friends are really mad at you. Because they blame you for their capture. They're saying you're the one who left his gun at the house. And he got really angry, and he said, that was so-and-so who left the gun at the house, and here's everything I know about him.
Uh-huh.
And I had made up the entire story.
So obviously deception is a big part of the game.
It can be.
Calling it a game, but I know it's not a game. It's real life, and it's hard stuff. But at times you're playing a little mental game with them, right?
It's mental chess in a lot of ways, and it's very similar to what we do in criminal investigations. There's a lot of deception that goes on in criminal investigative interviews. The courts have allowed that, and because they realize that, you know, when a suspect comes in, they're going to be deceptive. There is a lot of deception that goes on, but eventually you've got to get to a moment of truth in the middle where you both can negotiate and cooperate.
This may sound like a stupid question, but I got to ask it. Is that fun? When you trick the guy into giving away information he didn't want to give you, you must have a poker face on the outside, but inside you're going, I got this guy. I got him.
For me, it was just a challenge, and I enjoyed the competition of it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the fact that I'm facing off with somebody. And to be quite honest, you know, sometimes I'm sure that they were saying the same thing about me,
mm-hmm.
that maybe they tricked me into thinking that I believed something they told me was true that wasn't. And so there was always this competition between us going on in the interrogation booth. Within my team, we had a competition to see who could be the most effective and use these techniques and be the best at developing rapport and getting prisoners to cooperate.
Was there a prize at the end of the day for the guy who got the most confessions and that sort of thing?
I think it was a joint prize, and the whole task force took that prize, and it was to be able to eliminate Zarqawi.
Yeah, you sure did.
Save lives.
If you don't mind, Matthew, I'm going to impose upon you to tell a story that I know is in the book, but I really would like you to share with my listeners. And it has to do with the notion of how you interrogate children. Because you talk in the book about one boy who you had to interrogate who was 12 years old, and you use the phrase in the book, brainwashed.
Yeah, let me paint the picture, because I don't want anybody to get the impression that we interrogate children, because we don't, and it's not our policy. But what had happened is we were trying to capture the boy's father, and his father was hosting suicide bombers. He was coordinating suicide bombing attacks. In fact, this was the house where we found the last footage of Zarqawi that probably many people have seen on TV. And when we tried to capture his father, these suicide bombers had blown themselves up and killed this boy's parents. We actually had tried to save his mother and went through extraordinary lengths to try and save her, but weren't able to. So we had no choice, the soldiers had no choice, but to bring him back to our facility. We didn't put him in prison, we put him in a nice room with a comfy mattress, and we coddled the boy, really. But when he got into the interrogation booth, you know, the first thing he said to a female interrogator was, you're not wearing a scarf, you must be a whore. And
12
one of my
years
other
old.
Interrogators, he said to her, he said to him, if you're an infidel, I should cut your head off right now. But instead of trying to, degrade this boy or interrogate him or try to change his mind about his beliefs, what we did is we just praised him and asked him about all why he was so important and why he thought he was so important. And in the process, he described all the places his father had taken him and outlined an entire network of suicide bombing operations, which we went out and took out.
Wow. There's a part of me that wonders at what age that hatred for Westerners or people unlike the ones he knew, when did that start? Because I know that we've got problems in Saudi Arabia with some of these Wahhabist madrasas teaching kids hate for the West and Jews and Americans at a very early age. Is that where that's growing for most of these people, or is it just in the home?
I would say, based on my experience, from the home. Are there madrasas that teach hate and preach a very extreme ideology? Yes, but I think they're very few. I think there's a lot of madrasas that criticize America's policies, but don't necessarily preach hate towards Americans. And in the case of this boy, I mean, this is the example of how of the small percentage of extremism that does exist, but how extreme it is. And this boy's father obviously had bought completely into Zarqawi's ideology, was behind suicide bombings, and had, you know, been steeping his son to carry on his work. And so what I pose in the book is a question, is how do we bring these people back? How are we going to change that next generation that has been stewed in this? And in the case of this boy, it turns out that near the end of his stay with us, you know, we had been treating him nice the whole time. The rhetoric started to die down, and he started to see us not as these evildoers as he had been taught, but as people.
Wow. Matthew, what's your take on the shoe-throwing incident with President Bush and the Iraqi reporter the other day?
I couldn't really see what type of shoes they were. I'm not sure if they were leather or suede, so I can't really comment on that.
But the act itself?
You know, I understand why a lot of Iraqis are upset with the current administration because of the mistakes that were made in Iraq. And I think, you know, to some degree, those mistakes were based on cultural ignorance and a failure to acknowledge the deep rift that existed in Iraq between Sunnis and Shias and the favoritism that we played at the beginning of the war and how we isolated Sunnis from the process and alienated a lot of people. And so I understood that man's frustration. I don't condone his act, but I understand his frustration because my team of interrogators and I, we heard it every single day in the interrogation booth.
Do you expect that perception of America and our leadership to change once our leadership does change on January 20th to the Obama administration?
Well, let me say this. You know, I give several examples in the book of people who I sat down with and would have cut my head off if I'd have given them a knife, who within hours, in some cases, were then my friends and were working with me and cooperating with me. And you know what it takes to get to that point, because it can happen very quickly, is it takes us admitting our mistakes, and sometimes it just all it took was me just to give an apology, and then offering a way forward of working together. And it takes showing respect to them. And that doesn't mean in any way that we're going to sacrifice what we believe in. It just means that we have to be able to find a way to negotiate and cooperate.
Matthew, let me finish up here by thanking you for your service. And I say that to everyone who's wore the uniform of the United States, but particularly to you and your fellow interrogators and the analysts behind you who were able to accomplish all of the stuff that you did and saved lives and got Zarqawi and everything. All Americans should be very thankful for that, and I think for the message that you're spreading here today and in your book as well.
Oh, thank you very much for saying that. And, you know, it's dedicated to all the troops, and just remind American people that, you know, we've lost a lot of troops in this war, and support your troops.
Absolutely. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Alexander, the book is called How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. I'm Paul Harris. This is The McGraw Show on the Big 550 KTRS.